Why do people still get married today? Why do they? No. But why do? Why is it so serious for them to get divorced? Are the salaries, I didn't stay long enough to inquire that, but the art is destructive.
I think one problem we have today, which we do not have here, to anywhere near the same extent, is divorce involves enormous housing problems. Often you have cases where, because of the housing shortage, you have cases where divorced people continue to live in the same apartment for years. And well, you can imagine what that situation results in. So I think alcoholism plays a very high, is a very high reason for divorce now. And not to the same extent here at all.
What happens to the family, though, to the mother, once there is a divorce?
Well, I think your situation now is much more similar to ours in the sense that women are still, to a large extent, concentrated at the lower end of the pay scale, but it's nowhere near the kind of thing we're talking about in the 20s, where you have, for example, you don't have the unemployment that you had in the 20s. The majority of women are working, and they don't have a problem with unemployment. So that's not a question at all. I think that women would suffer to a certain extent from divorce, but it's nowhere near the kind of thing that we're talking about in the forums.
I have a question about this. It struck me listening to Bob talk about Germany in the 50s, this inclusion of reproduction in the economic equation, that reproduction was seen as being important to the economy, this economic recovery of Germany. Is this mainly in the sense of physically then reproducing the labor force? And where does this come from? Are there origins in, say, National Socialist thinking for this, or is this a kind of new twist on it?
Well, I think it's farther back than that. I think it's from the home economics movement, which does kind of budget studies even before the First World War, even more so in the 20s. And then what was really interesting to me in discovering this is its overlap with sort of the post-1973 discussion around wages for housework and the kind of Marxist discussion around productive versus unproductive labor. But here it's taking place largely within the camp of Catholic social theorists who are out dealing in their zeal at defining how much women's non-wage labor is worth. And they say real explicitly that it's good that women don't just work for these family allowances, because they'd only make 17 pennies an hour. No one in their right mind would work that much. So it's good that they also love their children. But this is productive labor. It's even more explicit in the family law debates, where the basis on which you can make demands for alimony are the equation of unpaid labor with work outside the home. So that you only get your wages when you get divorced, in a sense.
I would just add to that, though, that I would say this back before the home economics movement. It goes into a very, very deep racism that is a neo-COVID racism that goes back to, I would go back to the Wilhelmian Empire and the fear of the Eastern Boys and Jews in whole and the need to reproduce Germans, and then the Nazis exacerbate that clearly. And then in the 50s, and not the 50s, then you get the period where they need people, so they need to reproduce Germans, but they also accept people from the Mediterranean and from the East. And then you get and from Turkey. And then today you get this incredible racism that's reappearing, which is the anti-Turkey show. And that's got to be when let's produce more little blonde Germans. So.
There's a real racism in the 50s as well. I mean, in terms of what's amazing is you get these Nazi demographers who reappear in the 50s.
And population policy.
Totally rehabilitated. The graphs are exactly the same as they were in the 30s, but it's now a contrast not with the Slavs, but with the people of Africa and the Yellow Peril. It's a big threatened to, I mean, it was a little overwhelming to me. And another element of continuity, I think, with the Nazi business realized the kind of racialist policy of labor importation to preserve a specific family ideal in the 60s, so that you never get the labor force participation rate for married women in the federal republic that you did say in this country. So that it has a real meaning. I mean, you go from forced labor of one variety in the 30s to, and the 40s to forced labor of another variety like 50 to 160. No, I would certainly agree that there is a kind of peculiar variety of racialism which would also appear to be traced back into the 1890s at least.
Could I come back to my question about Stalin? Right now it's obvious if you travel in Central Asia that there are huge families, whereas in Moscow you have maybe one child and a half. Is there such a thing? And I think the Soviet government is rather worried about that, and then Karev, of course, has written a lot about that. Was there a similar fear under Stalin? Why did he have that very regressive marriage and family policy?
Well, I think that some of the reasons that he listed are correct in terms of why there was a very aggressive family policy. I think the thing that's really interesting about that, in terms of regressive and progressive and what that means, basically here I describe laws that are quote progressive, right? But their target, namely peasant and working class women, I mean, who the aim of the liberation, are people who are basically opposed to them. And opposed to them for very good, concrete, material reasons. I think that we can understand once we begin to explore the social context of their lives. And if you take a look at the Stalin legislation of 36, which is basically legislation that, one, prohibits abortion, two, gives aid to women with many children, three, sets up an enormous grid of daycare centers because women are moving into the workforce in record numbers, and provides more social services for women. I think that one of the problems in just saying, well, this is part of a Stalinist control over the individual, or Stalinist control over the family, what that doesn't tell us is that if you take a look at the kinds of things that women are saying in the 20s, they're basically agitating for a similar set of policies. Not the prohibition of abortion, I don't think that was true, but in terms of making divorce harder to get, in terms of increasing aid to women with many children, in terms of increasing the grid of childcare institutions, those are all things that women would have been in favor of. So I think one of the things that happens when we start actually doing social history and looking at or trying to get at how women themselves, women who, let's say, were not officials, did not write, were not part of the Politburo or whatever, what they thought about the situation, what they thought about their lives, is that you're forced to rethink in certain ways this particular aspect, at least, of Stalinism, and to perhaps begin taking a look at what the social bases of support were for Stalinism, which is a tremendously complex question. But I think I've tried, at least in this paper, to kind of point in that direction.
Just to pursue that, and there is, of course, another route, right? I mean, you could have the more progressive code combined with the appropriate supports for women. There's a way in which social history sort of recreates the conditions as they were. That's not what you're doing. There's a way you stated that last part that made me very uneasy. And one can imagine other state policies which would make that code work. But it didn't work. You see, it was easier to make the law regressive than it is to change structures.
See, what's interesting to me is that the kinds of structures that you're talking about changing in the 20s, let's just stay with the 20s for a minute, are so enormously embedded in society that what it would have required to truly create socialism, the socialist vision for women in that situation of backwardness, scarcity, family, poverty, was something that the state at that particular point in time was in no way capable of undertaking. I think you're right. Deep structural changes were necessary. But I didn't even go into the whole question of what this family law looks like in the countryside or the peasantry. I mean, that's unbelievable. And there you're talking about changing not just structures, values of patriarchy, you're talking about changing the very mode of production in the countryside, which is the family household, in order to be able to liberate women. Yeah. So,
see, but that's, of course, that what the Chinese tried to do, what they smiled at me, was exactly that. Because the whole way, which I agree with, the whole way of your favor was towards the development of productive forces to make possible further change. So then you can look at China as an effort to subvert that necessity and failure. And failure. But it's at least an interesting thing to put next to it. Because they really do try.
I was going to raise the question on China. I couldn't hear exactly what it was. I only got a little piece of all this.
Sorry.
But the whole regressive and progressive are words that mean different things depending on where you're starting from. And I found your explanation on Stalin and what happened very interesting. It seemed to me that after the revolution, when so many progressive statutes, laws were passed, with no attempt at getting people to be able to handle what the laws were giving them. It was really much more than anybody could handle at that point, and havoc at the chaos developed. Now in China today, with the limitation of the family, and certainly it's based and it's targeted on the peasant family, where it's having very little results. Because it takes a long time to get these things going. The important thing is that the national economic needs of the country are being considered, and reproduction as such is in conflict there. You're going to have a large population, which China certainly has, and you can't feed them, then you have other problems. So limiting the family, which seems like a terrible thing to do to a family that wants two children or three children, yet the national policy is such that it's necessary to limit the population of China. Now, would you call it regressive, or would you call it progressive? Or what do those words mean anyways?
I mean, I think that's an excellent point, because it's been very hard for me, in terms of talking about state policy towards women and the family, to label things in that way. I use the word progressive here, and I think in some abstract sense, there's no question what they tried to do was very progressive. Its actual impact was not progressive, it was regressive, in that what happened was men picked themselves up, went down to the registry office, signed a little form, got themselves divorced, did that, you know, 15 or 20 times, and left women with the kids in a situation where they couldn't get jobs. So, is that progressive legislation? No. But, I mean, it's a hard question to come at.
Well, also the question of progressive for whom, that is the interest of an individual or a particular family then, I mean, that wants a son to carry on the family in China, and they have their one child who's been born and it's a daughter, versus the long-term interest, if one buys the argument that the resources that China has, its productive capacity, couldn't possibly develop fast enough to sustain the population growth in which every family had two children, then you're weighing the collective interest, I guess, versus the interest of particular families and people, and then what is progressive or who, how do you, what are the priorities for making
Yeah, in China, I wanted to ask the person over there to comment on your point. You said it failed in China, and I'm wondering, did it fail because of this embedded patriarchy of being a son and because the daughter went to the other commune? In other words, it was the woman that kept leaving the family or leaving the commune unit and being of less economic worth. Mm-hmm. The woman was of less economic worth to the family, and later became of less economic worth to the commune because at marriage you leave the commune. Mm-hmm. Is that
yes.
one of the reasons?
Ah, yes.
Oh, okay. Fine. So that nobody really has attacked patriarchy and the patriarchal structure of the family.
Well, I have great hopes for Gaddafi, but I missed it.
Maybe this is an appropriate place to end with a new quote, Feminism in the Year 2000. And I thank you for my co-presenter and to all of you.
I'm going to go to the next one.